broadcasting from the city centre.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello, happy Halloween, and welcome to the Cambridge Film Show, the artist formerly known as Bums on Seats, here on Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last hour, but now it's time to settle back and enjoy the insights and reviews of our regular team on what's available to watch at your Cambridge cinema of choice. I'm Emma Marchant, and helping me navigate the spooky movie Ghosts and Ghouls today in the studio are Vicky Eyre.
Hello.
Yossi Osman.
Hello.
Stuart Pask.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
And Ashley Whittaker.
Hiya.
We are spoilt for choice this Halloween weekend with Wes Anderson's latest candy-coloured all-star idiosyncratic opus, The French Dispatch, Broadway hit turned West End hit turned film, Dear Evan Hansen. Plus, Tom Hardy is back as both Eddie Brock and the diabolical Venom in Venom, There Will Be Carnage. And to top it all off, we will revisit Haddonfield through the eyes of Michael Myers and the ultimate final girl, Laurie Strode, in the latest Halloween instalment, Halloween Kills. And we might even give you our own top choices for Halloween movies to stream in the comfort of your own home. So lots to pack in, but let's begin by travelling to Arrakis for Denis Villeneuve's long-awaited version of Frank Herbert's beloved sci-fi opus, Dune.
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known. What's to become of our world?
Boy.
Duncan, can I trust you with something?
Yes, always, you know that.
I've been having dreams about a girl on Arrakis. I don't know what it means.
Dreams make good stories. But everything important happens when we're awake.
Hey, you put on some muscle?
I did?
No.
After tackling another beloved sci-fi franchise with Blade Runner 2049, French-Canadian director Denis Villeneuve is finally back in the multiplexes and IMAXes with his take on Frank Herbert's best-selling Dune. A starry cast is led by Timothée Chalamet as the noble Paul Atreides, son... I don't know if I pronounced it that right because I haven't seen this, but someone will correct me, I'm sure. Son of Duke Leto and Lady Jessica, played by Oscar Isaacs and Rebecca Ferguson, who are ordered to take over the rule of Dune, home of the most valuable substance in this far future galaxy, spice. But there are other visions and prophecies which may dictate a different future for Paul. Vicky.
Yes.
This has been highly anticipated as one of the bigger releases that was delayed due to COVID, and also comes, obviously, after the sort of under the long shadow, shall we say, of David Lynch's 1984 version. Was it worth the wait?
So not having remembered David Lynch's like version, because I watched it when I was very young, although I do remember it being not this film. This film is, one, it's gorgeous. I think Denis's like cinematography is known throughout his past films, so just being very awe-inspiring and just very long, great landscapes. Is it worth the wait? Yes, the 2-hour 35 runtime doesn't feel like that at all. Having watched like the French Dispatch just before, and there was so much information in that film, whereas and it's only at 1 hour 43, I guess. This felt like shorter almost. Like you wanted more when the film ended, and obviously, I don't know if anyone else knew, but I didn't realize it was a part one when I walked in and I came and I was like, okay. So I'm very excited that the second part has been announced and that it's going to get filmed within the next year or so.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask that because it literally, I think it was always meant to be a part one and then it was confirmed officially, I think, about 2 days ago. Simon, did you think, does it work as a standalone or, as a standalone film? Could you see this and get as much enjoyment out of it? Or do you really maybe need to wait until and see part two at the same time, or is it a double bill? What did you think?
It could have worked as a standalone film. It was a very, very brave decision of them to make it, knowing that they weren't guaranteeing a part two. The book Dune is known to be very, very thick with story and, you know, backstory, history, characters, and very quite a complex plot, which is one of the reasons the David Lynch film didn't quite work when they tried to fit the entire thing into a two-hour film. Here, they somehow managed to take the time and tell a very concise story, which wasn't too overly complicated, relatively quite easy to follow, because there's so much of it they just don't mention, don't talk about, and they just give you the benefit of, you know, thinking the audience is intelligent. They know what they're talking about. They can follow it. They don't need the entire back history of every single character or exposition to just enjoy what you have in front of you, even so it's there and it's grounded.
This film definitely lets you breathe throughout. Like, you definitely take it all in.
Yeah. But they've chosen the arc of Paul Atreides, who later becomes Paul Maudib. There's a line in the film about the old Paul must die before the new Paul is born. And this is a complete character arc for the old Paul. So it does stand up as a single film, but it's one that really should be seen. You don't need to wait for the second one to come out. Get to see it in the cinema as soon as you can.
As soon as you can. Yossi, you saw this, and I know that you were, I don't believe you were sort of terribly overexcited about it, but I think you were pleasurably surprised, no?
I really don't like sci-fi that much. And when I went to see this, I had kind of visions in my head of what this would be. But I really went along with it in the cinema. I think it is absolutely stunning to watch. I think it's fair play to be on the... It's like he travelled to 10,000 and whatever year it is and actually filmed it from the future. It was beautiful to watch. But I was worried about the storytelling. And I think some other people think it's a bit slow-paced. But for me, it wasn't. It worked. I was fully invested in the characters. I really, really believed in the story. I believed in the background. You know, it's quite hard to tell a whole retelling of a world. You know what I mean? To tell the story of a whole world and different... I want to say planets, but I'm going to be very... I'm probably not describing it quite correctly. But just these... It did it really well for me. And I think... it's a bit like a who's who when you're watching it. There's so many different stars that just appear at different moments. And I will talk about Jason Momoa, because he was my favourite character in the whole thing. But all Jason Momoa needed to do was just show up and do his action, Matt. Like, he was brilliant. He was absolutely... It has everything that you might need from a film of this level. I was pleasantly surprised the whole way through.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, because I mentioned, obviously, three of the stars there, but this film is... As the French Dispatch is, it's like everyone's come back after COVID and was so bored they'll take on any show. It's like all actors in all films. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you haven't just got the people I mentioned. You've also got Zendaya, Jason Momoa, Stellan Skarsgård, Josh Brolin, even Dave Bautista pops up in this. Were there any standout? I mean, is it Timothée Chalamet's film though? Does he carry it?
It is. I would say. Sorry.
Yeah, I've never been that impressed with Timothée Chalamet, and people saying, "Oh, he's going to be a star," and I can't see why. And he's headlining this film, and he absolutely owns it. And he owns a character. You can believe from him. Zendaya is a bit of a miss sell because she's barely in it. So
she's
despite
like
being all the trailers, she is only. So don't go to see it for Zendaya. But you did remind me about the only drawback and problem I have with this film is Jason Momoa shaving his beard.
I would like to say I think it's Rebecca Ferguson's film, because I thought she was phenomenal in it, and I love her very much, so it was really great to see her in a meaty role like this, and I fully believed every scene she was in, so I want to shout out to her.
There was an interview recently and they were saying like how she got into the character of it, and it's because he chose to film it in the deserts, like instead of the green screen she like put so much representation on him for like taking them to Jordan to film these gorgeous scenes, and that's how she's so captivating in it, because she was like fully in her role.
And maybe that's also, as Yossi was saying, that's how he manages to sort of make this story feel so real, this universe feel so real. But I am going to ask Stuart quickly, because I think there may be slightly tempering view over here from Stuart. What did you think, Stuart, being a huge sci-fi fan?
If this universe is real, I don't want to live in it. At least on first viewing, I found it a bit too slow for my liking. I quite like to be a little bit more action in my sci-fi films. But I think maybe it's just me, because I think the Dune, the novel, is it a 1965 novel? 65. It's known for being quite inaccessible. You've got to go in guns blazing to really sort of, and with real enthusiasm for it, because it's, as we mentioned, it's full of so many subplots and storylines. But I just found it very slow and very difficult to get into it. I think perhaps it may warrant a second viewing. Maybe I was missing something. Maybe I was in the wrong mood the first time round. But it did feel a bit too long. It did feel like it was dragged out too much. And I don't think it needed a second film. But by the same token, you already mentioned that the first film was possibly too short because there's too much to deal with one film. I don't know. It's just, I was disappointed because for me, I'm meant to be a huge sci-fi nerd and I couldn't get on board with it.
A final question. Did you guys watch it on IMAX or standard?
I saw it in IMAX and
would you recommend
I would
that?
Recommend it, not for the picture, which, as we keep saying, is stunning, but for the sound. The sound design, the Hans Zimmer score, the machines, the whole thing. It's a full assault on you. It puts you there in the picture.
Okay, well, that's great. That is Dune, which I think generally has got very positive reviews, ravishingly beautiful, if a little slow. Rush to your nearest IMAX or standard to go and see it. It's showing at the View and the Light and the Picture House, and it's a certificate 15. Right, moving on. In 2016, a coming-of-age musical hit Broadway and caused a buzz which was second at that point probably only to Hamilton. Dear Evan Hansen, telling the story of a socially anxious teen who, through a tragedy not of his own making, and then the power of social media, becomes increasingly popular and then trapped in a lie which he cannot escape.
Dear Evan Hansen, today is going to be an amazing day, and here's why.
Have you been doing those letters to yourself with Dr. Sherman?
I've been trying to.
Have you ever felt like nobody was there?
No one signed your cast. Now we can both pretend we are friends.
I'm sorry about my brother.
Have you ever felt forgotten in the middle of nowhere?
I wish everything was different. Wish I was part of something. I wish that anything I said mattered.
Have you ever felt like you could disappear?
Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah, that's mine. I'll just take it.
Wait, I need that back.
You could fall and no one would hear.
Connor took a letter from me and it was an assignment from my therapist.
Still.
Even when the dark comes crashing through.
Connor's mother and stepfather are here to see you.
When you need a friend to carry you.
Connor wanted you to have this.
And when you're broken on the ground.
Dear Evan Hansen, he wrote it to you.
His last words. Connor took his own life.
He won. I'm sorry Connor didn't write this.
No, please.
The original stage show of Dear Evan Hansen was a huge success, sweeping Emmys up for its bookwriter Stephen Levinson, lead actor Ben Platt, and songwriters Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, fresh off their success with The Greatest Showman. Its massive transfer to the West End was cut short by, what else, COVID, so now it hits the big screen. Just actually, it's reopening in the theatre in London, starring the original Broadway star Ben Platt, along with Julianne Moore, Amy Adams and Caitlin Dever. Directed by Stephen Chbosky, who has teen movie chops with Perks of a Wallflower and Wonder, this should have been a surefire hit, but instead it has landed with flat reviews and perhaps talk of miscasting. Yossi, you were super excited about this because you loved the stage show. Did it live up to your high expectations?
I'm going to say yes and no here. So I think what Dear Evan Hansen has as its selling point is has absolutely wonderful music. It's very easy to get swept up in it. There are some things, and I know my fellow esteemed reviewers here are going to disagree with me, but it has a really powerful story to some extent. I think it's very brave with its telling of mental health. And I think it's really refreshing to see a film that tackles mental health, particularly in teenagers, the way it does. I'm not condoning all of the behaviour that happens in the film, but I think there are some really smart choices. I don't know how much I can give to the film because a lot of that is in the stage show. And I think for me, the things that I love about it are the things that I loved in the stage show. The music, the storytelling, that's all from the stage show. There are other things that I didn't think translate that they didn't translate as well on screen for me. I think when you are taking something that's done so well on stage and you are adapting it to a film, you can't make simple choices. You've got to decide on how it's going to look on camera. And I think sometimes the impact was lost because it didn't look as good on screen. So I'm a bit mixed on it, but I still really enjoyed it. I have a feeling that some of the others here in this room did not enjoy it as much.
I am going to move on to Simon next, but I did warn everyone to play nicely before we went on air. Simon, you've just admitted that you really didn't like La La Land or The Greatest Showman either, which are both the Pasek Paul musicals, in inverted commas, before this one. Did this change your mind?
It did not change my mind. I cannot remember any of the songs or any of the music from this film. The next day, completely forgetful. Not like when I saw, for example, Hamilton in the middle of lockdown. And the next day and next week, nearly every song gets stuck in your head. This one just completely fell flat. I can't think of one of the worst films I have seen in a cinema in such a long time.
Surely not.
We had several walkouts in my screen, and I really wish I could have joined them. The storyline's been done before, almost, in an old film starring Robin Williams, written by Bobcat Goldthwait, called World's Greatest Dad, where his son commits suicide and he starts faking the suicide note and letters to try and make him sound much better person than he actually was. So it's kind of been done before. But that knew it was a black comedy. I think the biggest problem with this, when it is trying to tread such risky subject lines, is I think it almost tries to become too earnest for the millennials, and it just came across as insincere and offensive. It may be because I'm older, I'm, you know, Generation X, where we've had films that tackle anxiety, self-acceptance and teen suicide, but normally with a stroke of light dark comedy in films such as like Heathers and Pump at the Volume. But quite often with comedy, you have a sense of a kernel of truth and the honesty, and that's what brought those films over. Whereas here, it might have come across differently on the stage show, but here in the film, it just, like I said, it just seemed insincere. None of the characters are likeable or relatable. I mean, some of the actions of the main character are quite reprehensible. And I'm, you
That's
know, it's
point.
Like my jaw was on the floor. I can't believe they're showing this, and I can't believe they're showing it so straight, honestly, like this is a good thing.
These people who are walking out of your screenings, were they walking out because they were bored? I'm going to come to you in a minute, Ashley. I also saw the stage show and I watched this. My issue with this is I just think it's a bit of a flat adaptation. And I remembered again that even as a musical, you've got two really great show-stopping numbers. I cannot believe you couldn't remember any of the songs. I take umbrage at that. They have two great show-stopping numbers, but then it just kind of fades out to a bit of a fizzle at the end. That was my issue with it, and it's overlong. But were people walking out, do you think, because they were offended? Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't know. I don't know whether they were offended or not. It could have been the quality. I mean, that's the thing with the light, with the pass. You get to go and see films you wouldn't normally like to see. It could be the fact they'd heard such great things about the musical and went in, and when it, you know, it could be when they found out what the plot was, they didn't like it. It could have been they didn't enjoy the music or the songs. And occasionally you think you have better things to do, you're not missing out anything, so you walk out. I mean, I was so tempted to join them. But
Ashley, you famously have, you know, we have very divided opinions, for example, on Hamilton, but you have strong opinions about musicals because you are a musical fan and what constitutes a musical and what doesn't. What did you make of Dear Evan Hansen?
I think the walkouts are because maybe this gets lumped in a lot with Everybody's Talking About Jamie. That's why it was suggested to me algorithmically anyway. And I started watching this and I was like, oh, this isn't what this is. So I think maybe people are thinking we're going to get a big happy clappy musical. This is going to be great. And we're also going to touch on a bit of mental health. It is not that. It's a dark teen film with some songs in it sung by the old looking guy. I felt it was earnest in a good way. What I didn't like is the way they treated the young person who took their own life, because all we see of him is a flash act of violence and then he's gone, and we're kind of speaking on his name this whole time. We know nothing about him, which does get tackled towards the end, but we are kind of using this young person's story to make this bigger story for everyone else, and we never meet him. And I wonder about the musical, because Ben Platt himself, the lead guy, has said they reworked the ending of this film, so his character took more ownership of his actions, because yes, he's very likable, he's very anxious, and his darling little mannerisms, you just feel so bad for him all the way through, and it's easy to forget, Jesus, like, what you did is reprehensible. So the ending, they've tried to make him a little more accountable, and he said that was different in the stage play. The guy who ends up taking his own life is also the second person to come back from Broadway. He played that character, so I wonder if it was a bigger character on stage.
Not particularly as
no, no. And I do agree with you. I do think that Connor, who is the teenager that took his life in the film, and the stage adaptation, they don't really pay a lot of attention to that character. It is kind of overlooked. To Simon's point around, you know, the main character isn't very likeable. He is quite reprehensible for what he does. I totally agree with that. But I don't think we're meant to really forgive him or like him for what he does. And the story doesn't really let him get away with his big lie, with that whole narrative. And I think that's the point. And I want to add something. I talked a little bit about its portrayal of mental health, which I don't think is perfect. But there is a song that they added in the film that is not in the stage adaptation, which Amanda Stenberg sings as Alana. It's called Anonymous, and it's how people who you imagine to have perfect lives don't. They might have something underneath that they are suffering from. And I thought that was a beautiful song, and I think it was really well sung. And I think it was very carefully managed. And I was imagining watching it as a teenager myself. And as a teenager, I think this film would have worked for me. And I just have to say that I want to give it its props, because I know it's got its faults, but I also want to give it its dues.
I will just come very quick. I'll come to you in a minute, Simon. I was just going to say I am a mother of teenagers, and actually I did watch this with one of my teenage boys, and he really enjoyed it, actually, and he thought Ben Platt was great. He didn't have my issue that he does. He's 28 years old, but he sings like an angel, Ben Platt. He has the most incredible voice. So from that point of view, it was good. But Simon, you clearly wanted to come back.
I mean, I didn't realise what Yossi said about that song with Amanda Stenberg. That was actually a song. I didn't realise that was for the film, because that was where it was a glimpse of what this film could have been. When I'd heard about it, it's about, you know, a school, a guy coming out, with, you know, trying to become more active and is in the school. And that could have happened as more of an ensemble cast and not the story that they actually chose with, which is one of the things got the problems. But I would say with the positive about here, I did actually think all the actors were really good. From Caitlin Dever, Amy Adams as always, Julianne Moore as always, Amanda Stenberg. They were all fantastic. And even Ben Platt's, with his mannerisms, really believable with his songs, and that was great. I just don't think any of them deserved to be in this film.
last question I was going to say. Like we said, it's come, it's landed to pretty poor reviews. However, as did The Greatest Showman, which is a Patrick Paul musical from before, and that, of course, famously went on to be one of the leggiest films, as they quote. Do you think this has got any chance of proving the critics wrong? I'm thinking no, because it's really on limited screenings already, and it doesn't have maybe the pull of Zac Efron and Hugh Jackman. But what do you think?
The kind of musicals that you watch over and over, the ones with the big dance numbers, the flashy sets, because that's why you watch them over and over again. This wouldn't be one I think even I would watch again. I'd watch it again for Ben Platt's performance, because I've never seen him in anything, and he's incredible. And how does he get that across on a stage when you've got thousands of people tens of metres away from you? I don't know, but on film it worked perfectly.
Excellent. Okay, so that was Dear Evan Hansen. That went better than I thought, actually. Dear Evan Hansen, and it's showing at The View and The Light, but it is pretty limited screenings. But if you fancy it and you can't get to London to see the stage show, then, yeah, go. OK, you're listening to the Cambridge Film Show. We have just about half an hour left on the show, and we're going to be wrapping up with a double whammy of Venom and Halloween thrills and chills and kills. But for now, let's take a trip to Ennui de Blasé through the fanciful imagination of Wes Anderson.
It began as a holiday. Eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, Arthur Howitzer Jr. transformed the series of travelogue columns into the French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, and diverse stories of human interest.
You don't think it's almost too seedy this time?
No, I don't.
For decent people.
It's supposed to be charming.
He assembled a team of the best expatriate journalists of his time. Berenson, Sazerac, Kremenz, Roebuck Wright. These were his people.
Just try to make it sound like you wrote it that way on purpose.
We take as the subject of tonight's lecture Mr. Moses Rosenthal. Certainly the loudest artistic voice of his rowdy generation.
Simone Naked Cell Block J Hobby Room. I want to buy it.
It's not for sale.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes.
In short, the picture was a sensation.
The kids did this. Obliterated a thousand. The French Dispatch is Wes Anderson's ninth feature-length film and is, as described by the director himself, a love letter to print journalism. With a cast so starry, it will probably take me the rest of the show to list them. It tells the story of the French Dispatch, a monthly publication from the Kansas Liberty Star, through five distinct parts: an obituary that we start off with, then three articles, and an endnote, switching from colour to black and white throughout, but maintaining Anderson's trademark blocking visuals and verbosity. Simon, I'm going to come to you on this. I don't immediately think of you as a Wes Anderson fan, but you can't deny that he is now really a key part of American cinema. He sort of got there by stealth almost. This has been accused of being too Wes Anderson, if such a thing is possible, or like Wes on steroids. What did you think? Was it a step too far for you into quirk?
I think it was a step too far. I mean, I've been watching Wes Anderson since Rushmore and never quite got the love of Steve Zissou, Life Aquatic, or the Royal Tenenbaums, but he recently brought me over with Moonrise Kingdom, which was just wonderful, and the Grand Budapest Hotel. But this was definitely a step further back into his quirk. I think one of the problems was the opening section and the way the story is told, and the opening section especially just seemed so cold and so quirky. It made it difficult to actually enjoy the rest of the film and sit down. And it was almost like mechanical, where it was like, I can enjoy these stories. Some of them are quite good. Oh, that's a nice little touch. That's a nice touch. But overall, nothing quite gelled. And I was just like bored and waiting for the next story or what they're going to do next. And couldn't actually truly invest in the characters or the film. I keep saying, it felt like this was the film designed for somebody like Frasier from the TV show. And I don't mean people who like the show Frasier. I actually mean Frasier and Niles. It's the kind of thing, the, you know, the upper class, intellectual, esoteric, you know, it, full of like in-jokes, which only the, you know,
intellectual snobbery
will get. And yeah, I just found it a little bit cold and disappointing. You know, there were plenty of highlights in it and it looks good, but there were plenty of points where you just shrug.
Vicky, there aren't so many famous people in this. Yes. I mean, for example, Christoph Waltz pops up, you know, Oscar-winning Christoph Waltz, and literally gets, I think, two lines. Do you think it was too much of a parade of cameos, or did that work for you?
It worked for me in particular, as obviously this cast is like Wes's cast. Like, you know, he's picked all his favourites, pushed them all into this film. But I think definitely with the main storylines, if we don't talk about Frances McDormand, like, I think the highlights were Tilda Swinton's and Benicio del Toro and Jeffrey Wright is the police commissioner's dining room story. I think those are like the two standouts, and he gives those time. And I think that's where I really enjoyed this film, is because I got very invested in the stories. Obviously, he's planned it out. And like I said, like, editing wise, it might have not been the best pacing that he has done. Like, it is information packed, and he could have definitely he could have even cut some scenes. I think maybe like he's definitely tried to get too many people in it, but I think he gave the spotlight to the right stories, and that's why I am such a fan of this film.
That's true, yeah. The first story is Benicio del Toro was, and Lea Seydoux, actually. And it was nice to see Lea Seydoux doing something a little bit more than being given what I thought was a rather gratuitous damsel in distress role in
No Time to Die.
In the recent Bond film. So I enjoyed seeing her. Yossi, again, coming to this, what's your feeling about Wes Anderson? What's your favourite, if you've got one, what's your favourite Wes Anderson film prior to this, and how do you feel about this?
I quite like Wes Anderson. I'm actually normally quite a fan of his. I love Rushmore, one of his earlier films, and I thought The Grand Budapest Hotel more recently was a brilliant film. So I actually was, I had high hopes to see this. I don't know if I was just in a bad mood when I watched it, if I just had a long day, I was tired, but I found myself, I just couldn't be bothered. I could not be bothered with the sheer Starbucks coffee shop style of the film. I'm so sorry, and I know people here loved it, but I just couldn't be bothered. The first story with
Owen Wilson
was brilliant. I thought the first story with Lea Seydoux and Benicio del Toro was good. After that, I thought the film lost its way. It was just too much style over substance for me, and it almost annoyed me. It didn't annoy me. sorry, it did sort of annoy me because I didn't even really get the story. I didn't understand, like, this is meant to be an homage to journalists. And I was like, is this really an homage to journalists? I didn't feel it was. I don't know. As you can tell, I was quite grumpy when I saw it. So maybe go to somebody else.
I did think to myself, I wondered what actually French people would make of this. I did think, because this guy, because all his other films, well, I guess, you know, he set films in different areas, but it's always this sort of weird, like you say, emotionally distanced, almost pastiche version of where someone is. So I did find myself thinking that. But I'm with Vicky in that it's hard not to be impressed by the first story and the last story. Liev Schreiber as well. I don't think I've seen Liev Schreiber in a... No, yeah, it is Liev Schreiber, isn't it? With Jeffrey Wright interviewing him. And I don't think I've seen him in a Wes Anderson film before. And I don't think I've seen Benicio del Toro in a Wes Anderson film.
Benicio del Toro is like, he stole the show in his character.
He was absolutely magical.
Yeah, I do agree.
Yeah, I mean, and Tilda Swinton was hilarious. Mm. And the colours of her scene as well, just that whole look, I was 100% there for that. But I did feel that perhaps the middle section was the least engaging. This was Francis, and this again is Timothée Chalamet, who's everywhere this week, playing sort of Zeffirelli, the student revolutionist or whatever, with awesome hair. But I do think that perhaps it's a shame that middle story was perhaps the least engaging, because it felt like it lost some pacing there. Whereas obviously it gets off to a great start with the delightful Owen Wilson bicycling. His bicycle.
It's very Cambridge Owen Wilson story, I would say. Yeah. Just seeing him on his bike with his little notepad. I'm like, this is kind of made for a Cambridge audience, I would say. Just the first, 10 minutes of it.
I hear the phrase.
I said it was a problem where I didn't like the Owen Wilson one, and I think that turned me off the film so much. It was difficult to get back into, despite Benicio del Toro and Lea Seydoux story being more and more interesting. So it was definitely ups and downs. It's like just getting there. And then you have the middle story and it's like, oh, can't be bothered again. And then it gets a little bit better towards the end. You know, it's...
I really enjoyed it. And I think as well, I'd be having... At the moment, it seems like films are incredibly long. We talked about this, I think, you know, in our show, and it's true. Bond was nearly 3 hours. Dune is two hours, 35 minutes or whatever. So to go and see a fairly sprightly hour and 45 minutes, distinctly split, so you knew also where you were in the film, you know how long it's going to take. That's not really a rave review, is it? I'm my absolute favourite Wes Anderson is Moonrise Kingdom, because I think he brings some emotion into this. This, again, is very emotionally distant. But I must give a shout out actually to Edward Norton, who pops up in that last story, and also Saoirse Ronan, who I really... But you blink and you'll miss her. I mean, blink and you'll miss so many of these people.
I didn't even realise she was in it. I did not spot her.
She was in the kid. She was one of the kidnapping gang in the last season. So in the last episode. So I think then we can say, if you like Wes Anderson, you're going to like this.
I love Wes Anderson. I loved it. But I mean, Simon's looking. I mean, he is a fan. So to be honest, when I went with my friends, it was a divided crowd, and I think it was divided between who had a coffee that morning and who had, like, was still waiting for their caffeine, because I was, like, very well into all the information that was getting thrown at me, and so it just blew past other people. Yeah. I would say that that's, yeah, what's happened.
I went with two girlfriends who very rarely go to the cinema, and they both loved it. They were both enchanted.
I know as Anderson fans who have absolutely loved this, it's one of the ones, it's on the borderline between his hit and misses for me.
Yeah.
So you can go either way. But I don't think it's going to convert anybody to Wes Anderson films.
No, I was going to say, don't use this as an entry into his oeuvre. Perhaps start elsewhere, see how you feel about that, and then see The French Dispatch. But, you know, I think there is a place in our cinema world for Wes Anderson, and certainly most of Hollywood would think so, because they all seem to want to work with him. So that's The French Dispatch. It's a certificate 15, and it is showing at The Light and The Picture House.
On Women Making Waves this week, we meet acclaimed pianist Brenda Lucas Ogden, widow of John Ogden.
And Patricia Farah is a historian of science whose area of interest includes the role of women in science. All on Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio this Sunday at 10 a.m. and Friday at 2 p.m. or catch us online anytime.
If you're like me, you've got a family and a business, and you want to protect what's most important when the chips are down. With Woodfine Solicitors, that's exactly what happens. I got a bespoke legal service from a friendly, expert team. They really listened to what was going on and tailored their recommendations to my situation, which was, well, that's another story. Anyway, the best thing was that it all happened online. A few simple clicks and I had my quote. That freed up time to focus on everything else. Get the help you need when you need it most. Visit woodfinds.co.uk or call Cambridge 411 421. Woodfinds, cutting through the red tape.
Coming into the home straight, we're going to finish up with some comic book mayhem with Venom, There Will Be Carnage, which is still packing them in, I think, even though it's been out for a couple of weeks. But first of all, let's take a look at the only new horror out in the cinema for this Halloween. And it is our 12th visit to Haddonfield, Illinois, home of the infamous Michael Myers. It's the only new horror.
Grandmother was right. The boogeyman was real.
It's over.
We can't hurt anyone ever again.
No one told you.
Perhaps a trailer that doesn't lend itself so much to audio, I would say. You need to really watch a lot of those horror set pieces. So, directed by David Gordon Green, previous indie stalwart, and now sort of turned his hand, now this is his second Halloween movie, and co-written again with Danny McBride and Scott Teams, this sequel to 2018's Halloween picks up exactly where that film finished. So, Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie Strode is in hospital with a stomach wound, committed by and believing that Michael Myers has been left to burn to death in the basement of the house. Alas, that is not the case. So she, her daughter and her granddaughter have to fend him off yet again, this time with the help of the entire town's population. And I'm not going to lie, the night ends up better for some than for others. Ashley, you are our resident Halloween screen queen, and you're so excited about this film because you're a huge franchise fan. And obviously, this was due to come out a year ago, but COVID kept it out of cinemas again for a year. So, how was it when you finally got to see it?
It was all right.
Okay, listen, it's not as good as the last one. The last one was incredible. So we've had a bit of a break. We had those cool, weird ones in the noughties that all seemed like little individual bits and pieces. And they tried really hard to make something unique each time. This time we've got a trio of films coming back with some of the original cast. So Jamie Lee Curtis has big parts in all these films now. And we're getting back to the real story of Michael Myers. And I really love that they brought in Judy Greer as her sidekick come daughter. And they are a powerhouse duo. I loved the first one in the trio and the ending, that massive crescendo where these three women just managed to trap him in this booby-trapped burning house. And you're thinking, surely this time he can't escape. But you know that's not the case because it's never the case. Of course he does escape somehow. They're leaning into the ridiculousness of the character of Michael Myers here. It's getting campy and it needs to because they need to stop taking themselves so seriously. This is a 7-foot monster. It's not a human because he's unkillable. So he's not a human, like Scream running around, a teenager in a mask with a knife. That's not what this is. And the camp comes when he manages to kind of slay an entire fire crew single-handedly. And like, you're never going to take this man down. So I'm excited to see where the third and final installment goes. He's going to have to die at some point. This little middle film is just kind of a love letter to the original franchise fans because we've got a lot of the original cast back from the very beginning, the 1978 film. And they're lovely little Easter eggs to see all their faces again, especially the little girl, the Fringe, whose babysitter was murdered at the beginning of the first film, who has now become Real Housewives of Beverly Hills royalty, Kyle Richards. She's actually an incredible actress, but you've got lots of the original kind of would-be victims from the 70s. That's what I enjoyed. The rest was okay.
Okay, you took... Actually, I was going to ask that question. With Halloween Ends being slated for 2022... did this feel a bit like a holder? But I think you sort of answered that. But Vicky, this hits the ground running. Like we said, it literally picks up, you know, as they're being rushed to hospital in an ambulance. So it's really heavy on the gore as well. I do not go and see horror films very often. There are some quite invented deaths in this, and I was having to watch some of them through, like, fingers.
You were well scared.
But it was less suspenseful. How did you feel about it? I mean, yeah, it didn't feel like a classic horror in that there was really no suspense. There was, for me, it was just...
No, I know. So I didn't know it was going to just pick up straight as soon as the last film ended, because I was a big fan of the last film that came out. I do agree with Ashley, the big crescendo ending. It was very campy in its characters. I fell in love with all of them. This one doesn't give me time to like anyone because they die within like seconds, and there's not a much likability to it. I was really looking forward to it. I thought when I realised it was a continuation, I thought, okay, I get to see some of the characters that I kind of still like, but I think with the pacing and these very talented deaths that have came about, it's just kind of like, is someone that loves horror. It's just a lot of gore and not enough of like the storytelling of the original. And I'm a big Halloween fan, and it doesn't even give the time for the music to breathe either. Like, you don't get the
You do get little flashes of the original music, don't you? It's got all the original music in it, but like you say, like tiny little bit, and then you know something's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a lot of death straight away without the suspensefulness of Michael Myers.
I went back actually and watched the original Halloween straight after this. I didn't see the 2018 Halloween, so I came into this pretty fresh. I think the last one I saw in the whole franchise was maybe Halloween H2O, but that was...
I loved that one.
That was like 20 years ago. I remember it all that well. But I went back and watched the original Halloween, and it did remind me of just how well that score and the suspense in the original, right up to that classic scene where she's in the house and all the bodies are just falling out of every crevice. That works really well. This, Simon, there's a scene in this that you know, everyone ends up in the hospital, and there it seems to be making, you know, it's definitely making a point about where true evil lies, and you know, and how it can, and that they have this insane mob scene in the hospital. Do you think it went deep enough into sort of answering these questions about mob mentality, and perhaps, you know, America in recent years, it's a very divided country? Do you think it was trying to make those points? Do you think it made that point? Do you think it just should have stuck with being, let's defeat Michael Myers?
I, I think it tried to make that point. I don't think it made it very well. It was a bit too much of an obvious point. There was the moment just before when he started building the mob, I was actually getting quite excited about this film. The first film was quite, as we're saying, quite inventive and reinvented a lot of the Halloween film. And this one, when it's like a mob and suddenly it's like the town versus Michael picking off the town, thought, great, we're going to get something different. And then they just had the hospital scene where the mob went after the wrong person and then Michael just kills everyone by one. And it lost all momentum. It was a long scene, but it's one of those scenes where you know how it's going to end 5 minutes, that section, 5 minutes before it happens, and you're just waiting out because it's starting to get predictable. And, you know, it's like, oh, OK, I can see you made the attempt here, but it really wasn't well. I mean, this one of the big problems with this film is that it wasn't scary. You know, it's supposed to be Halloween, it's supposed to be a horror film, it just wasn't scary. And
it's just a bit bloody and gory.
Yeah, I didn't know it was a third film is coming until after I'd seen it. And we were talking about Dune earlier and about how they did a standalone film without having an ending. This was not really a standalone film. This just ended up being 90 minutes of filler.
Well, yeah, because both Vicky and Ashley were saying how... Stuart, I'll come to you. Vicky and Ashley were both saying... I've forgotten you've seen that from them. I'm so sorry.
Vicky and Ashley were both saying
that the one before this ends up with this great kind of, like you say, the three women of three generations. Did it feel like Jamie Lee Curtis is a bit wasted in this one? Because basically she just lies in a hospital bed and has some emotive chats with Will Patton's injured Officer Hawkins in the other bed.
Do you think
it made the most of its cast? Or you can just tell me what you thought of it if you were.
to put it very briefly, because I was invited to see this having not seen the previous film, not having been told or have any idea that there was a previous film before this, and they all tied into each other. So when it hit the ground running, it really did for me, and I had no suspense. I didn't even have the previous film. So I would probably recommend, if anyone's going to go see this, make sure you've seen the previous one first, just to give the film its due, almost. But by the same token... It's already been said, it has no suspense. It doesn't have any of the slasher movie tropes. I don't watch a lot of horror films or a lot of slasher films, but I know the components that make them work and give them suspense and make them scary, and this film doesn't have it. And I was bored.
Fair enough. I couldn't say I wasn't bored, but then I was mostly, I think my jaw was on the floor because up pops Anthony Michael Hall in this film as Tommy Dornan.
How bad he looks.
Brian the Brain is long gone. He may have been eaten by the current Anthony Michael Hall, but I thought the casting's a little bit wasted. I did greatly enjoy that Donald Pleasance lookalike, though, that they have at the very beginning. That was great, playing the original psychiatrist. But I think we can all agree, then, that this isn't a great Halloween horror film. So instead, let's whip around the studio very quickly and ask people what they would recommend on streaming services, perhaps, to watch this weekend if you do want to get scared. Yossi.
Nightmare Before Christmas, Disney Plus. You can watch it at Halloween
and
you can watch it at Christmas. It's great. Watch it.
We watched it last night, actually.
There you go.
Simon, what would you throw out?
Well, most horror films, I think, can be watched at any time of the year. They don't need to be seen at Halloween. But one film that should be seen at Halloween, I think, is actually Trick or Treat, which you can currently get for, I think it's £2 on Amazon Prime. It is rental at the moment. But it's a nice anthology story starring Anna Paquin and Brian Cox from Michael Daughtry, who also did Krampus, a Christmas horror film.
I love Krampus.
So if you love Krampus, should give Trick or Treat a try.
Is this as in Brian Cox currently in Succession, Brian Cox?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes, not the astrophysicist Brian Cox.
Vicky, what would you throw out?
It's not a film, but it is like a short TV series with 10-minute episodes, and I'm going to say Over the Garden Wall, which is also on Amazon Prime. It's Elijah Wood as an animated brother trio, and it's a set of spooky little stories with a great ending. So that's my favourite.
Excellent. Ashley?
On Disney Plus, but don't be fooled, it looks super scary, and it's for ages 12 and up. It's called Just Beyond. It's a new supernatural anthology series, but based on the writings of R.L. Stine. So if you used to read him when you were little, he was scary. I should not have been allowed to read those when I was six
the
and
Goosebumps
seven.
Goosebumps guy. Yeah,
yeah, Goosebumps series guy. And even the front cover on the Disney Plus website, I'm going to be scared watching it.
Okay, Stu?
I'm going to be really lame. I'm not, as I've already said, I'm not big on horror, but I'd say just go and watch Ghostbusters because the new one's coming out soon and it's got ghosts in it.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts. I was going to say, actually, I watched on the recommendation of an Italian teenager we had staying with us over half term. He'd seen The Visit by M. Night Shyamalan. And actually, Simon's giving me a disgusted look. Vicky's giving me a thumbs up. It is available to rent for about £2.49. And I found it's a quirky little spooky, typically M. Night Shyamalan with the twist at the end. But it was creepy enough and it's an hour and a half. And I actually really enjoyed it, as did my kids. And it's only a PG-13. So there you go. Hope you find something to enjoy out of all of this. Right, I know it is hard to believe, but we do need to wrap up today's show. And we're going to be doing it with some Marvel action. What else? Because now we live in a genuine metaverse. Now Facebook is taking over the whole world and calling themselves Meta. We're all going to be part of the metaverse. So let's see where Eddie Brock and his friend are now.
All I ever wanted in this world is carnage.
Lady, we should be out there snacking on bad guys. I am a predator. I need to be free.
You have got to get control of your aggression, or you will get hauled off into Area 51.
Live in my body.
You live by my rules.
I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me. Please let me fix it so I can bring it again. You are a loser.
So the original Venom came out as this kind of cheeky Marvel mutant in 2018, with, I would say, the red hot at that point, Tom Hardy, as Eddie Brock, a schlubby yet charming journalist who accidentally merges with a monster and, you know, mayhem ensues. Despite appalling reviews for Venom, it mustered up enough ticket sales to justify this sequel. And we are now introducing Woody Harrelson, a serial killer and nemesis to both Eddie and Venom, Cletus Cassidy. Stu, how is this as an addition to the Marvel canon? Is it more, would you say, a Tom Hardy, Woody Harrelson feature? Interestingly, Tom Hardy did co-write the script, I believe. But what did you think of it? Was it funny enough? Was it violent enough? Was it fun?
Yes, on all counts. I think it's... For me, I found it quite funny, and I quite enjoyed the sort of the buddy comedy element that's between Tom Hardy and himself in effect, because I believe he does the voice acting for Venom as well. So I enjoyed that in the first film, and I'm happy to see more of this in this film. The post-credit scene from the first film obviously teased us, Woody Harrelson. I'm pleased to see him in this film. I think it's very good casting, and I think they made the right choice by sorting his hair out between the end credits of the first one and the actual hairstyle in this film, because it just fits a lot better and just doesn't look nearly as ridiculous. And for me, well, I think it's a no-brainer. I like Marvel films. This is just going to be sort of added on as another one that I enjoy. I will say it's not the best by any stretch, but it's fun. If you want to go and distract yourself for a few hours in the cinema, then this is perfectly good fun for doing that.
Well, like I said, it really is. It's showing. It's got a multitude of screenings at all the cinemas. When we were looking to check what was on this week, compared to Halloween Kills, which is, you know, like one screening a day or whatever, this is still packing them in, it would seem. Simon, Michelle Williams pops up again in this as Eddie's ex-girlfriend, now married to Reed Scott, and Naomi Harris, best known as Moneypenny, probably from Bond, is also there. Are they? But I find that Michelle Williams seems to be perennially underused in films. Are they underwritten as female characters? How does this represent women with Marvel's big, you know?
Michelle Williams. I mean, this isn't a Marvel film. This is not Marvel Cinematic Universe.
It's not Marvel.
It's is it Columbia?
Did.
So, you know, it's not got the same level as all the other Disney-owned Marvel ones. I think it's actually Columbia owns this one, not Fox.
Is it Sony?
Sony. Yeah, Sony. Michelle Williams is barely in it. She is so underwritten. She's barely in it. And to be honest, Naomi Harris doesn't actually fare much better. Is a character given almost no backstory apart from the love interest and the point of Woody Harrelson. That you got two films here. You got Woody Harrelson going mad as Carnage and trying to break out his girlfriend Naomi Harris, who's Shriek, I think her character's name is. And then you've got the Tom Hardy v Venom, Eddie Brock story, where they have a big fallout and trying to separate and come back again. It is purely the highlight. Films don't always have to be good to be enjoyable, and this one is just enjoyable. I always forget how much... I always think, oh, Tom Hardy, do I really want to see a Tom Hardy film? And I always go in, and every single time, I'm surprised at how good Tom Hardy is. He is absolutely brilliant in this. He is so funny. The interactions between him and Venom are just fantastic. This was the film we actually sparked off a conversation off-air last time, which we mentioned several times on air and here, about how good short films can be. And we want to see more short films. It's 97 minutes long. It whizzes by. It does not overstay its welcome. It's condensed 90 minutes of fun. I think I was halfway through and suddenly realised, hang on a minute, we're in the middle of the climax of the film here. Normally this would be like the twist in the second act, and it just gets out of the way. I would definitely recommend it to any fans of Spider-Man, Marvel films, Venom. If you just want a good mindless superhero film, you can't go wrong with it.
There perhaps have been some complaints. It's a PG-13, I'm presuming. Is it a little violent?
If anything, it's not violent enough, and that was my complaint. you got a Venom as a character who's known for wanting to always bite people's head off, but it's always off screen. They're doing the thing where they think violence is justifiable if you don't see it on screen, and that should not be the case. Violence is violence, whether it's on screen or not. So make it an 18, make it a 15, make it an 18. Please bring the violence back. The fact it's supposed to be a PG-13, 12A means it's all got taken off. And here, it's actually caused problems where you're not sure if characters are off-screen injured or dead because you don't see it anyway.
So, correct you, it is a 15. So it's
correct me, please. Thank you very much.
So it is a 15.
15.
But it has caused that sort of conversation that kids are going to have with their parents. And even at the Light Cinema here in Cambridge, they've also put out on their social media messages to remind people this is a 15. If you're under 15, you will not be admitted. So it's that sort of...
It is PG-13 in America. Which is why...
Okay, well, so you both enjoyed it. I think that's a pretty solid review to finish up for Venom, There Will Be Carnage. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We're going to be back in 2 weeks, as usual, when releases are going to include Last Night in Soho, the new big Marvel Cinematic Universe release, Eternals, and Ghostbusters Afterlife. We'll also be having a preview of the Cambridge Film Festival. Have a great Saturday. Goodbye.